Because when you can do that, when you can meet them, and instead of shrinking back and going, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do, you do know what to do, which is really just being, I'm going to be present with them right here, right now, exactly where they are. And there's more going on here than I completely understand, but I know something's going on and it's going to be okay.
Welcome to another Spotlight feature episode of Get Your Heart On, where I introduce you to some incredible people through intimate conversations, coffee talk style. We're talking serious, big-hearted people who are out there living their difference-making dreams to the max, whether they're on a mission to save the world or simply sharing smiles wherever they go. I'm super excited for you to meet today's guest I know you're going to love, whose specialty is death and dying. Bet you didn't see that coming. Welcome to Get Your Heart On. I'm Gia Duke. Hi, Martha Jo. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good to be here with you.
I'm so excited that you're here. Thank you. I'm going to share a little bit of your bio with everybody before we get started.
Okay.
Dr. Martha Jo Atkins wishes we didn't make dying so complicated. As a licensed professional counselor, master coach, and author, Dr. Atkins teaches about dying and grief with gentleness and humor. For 30 years, she has worked with people at end of life and the ones who love them. She is the author of the book Signpost of Dying, and her TEDx talk on the subject has more than a million views. You guys, really, it's so good. You have to check it out. She offers in-person and online education and retreats to individuals and groups. Dr. Atkins helps people around the world learn about dying and how the experience of caring for a dying loved one can be connective, rich, peaceful, and above all, full of love. Yes, please. And how amazing is that? Martha Jo and I met quite a few years ago through a Martha Beck Life Coach Training School that I was in, and she was one of my instructors. And I also had the privilege to hear her TEDx talk live called There's More to Dying Than Meets the Eye. And if you're a part of my big-hearted community and you've been with me for a while, you might remember her from my Super Love holiday call that we did quite a few years ago.
That was a long time ago.
A long time ago. I know. I was thinking back to that, though. You were such a great addition to the call. So Martha Jo not only has one of the most fascinating careers and is creating invaluable work in the world, she also has the most kind, genuine heart. Today, we'll be talking about extraordinary experiences at end of life and the language of dying and how to create less fear around death. Does that sound fun?
Yes.
Yes, right? In all seriousness, don't worry, you guys. Martha Jo has some fascinating stories and research to share with us. Her work truly is educational and inspiring. She's got such a fantastic sense of humor to go right along with it. So are we ready?
Ready.
We're ready. All right. Quick reminder, this is going to be a longer episode, as all my Spotlight features are. So feel free to listen in one sitting or break it up into two parts. Go grab your favorite beverage or whatever you want. Kick back somewhere cozy. And we'd be delighted for you guys to join in with us. So here we go. Welcome again, Martha Jo. Thank you so much for being here with us today, especially with all that's happening right now with the coronavirus pandemic. I know we've been talking about having you on the show for quite a few months, and I'm thinking our conversation probably couldn't be more timely. How about you?
It's interesting timing for sure.
So yep. Interesting. Yeah. So I shared a little bit about what you do in the intro, but I think it's always way more fun and personal to find out more about you from you. So can you share with us, outside of your work, first of all, maybe a few things about you, like where you live, what do you enjoy, some hobbies, so we can get to know you?
Sure. I live in San Antonio, Texas. I've lived here since 92, I think. And I've got a partner, Suzette, who I've been with for 10 years. And we have three dogs and a cat. And I love to do filmmaking. That's the newest thing that I've gotten into. And I'm having so much fun making films of people. And I'm learning all about editing now. And hope to get some of that out in the world pretty soon. I love music. I love the dogs. I love dogs.
Yes, we have that in common.
Name, not the people name. Yeah. Yeah, and your new dog is beautiful.
Oh, thank you, Sammy. She's such a character. And Joe Boxer is quite, yes. You guys, when you find Martha Jo on social, you're going to meet her Boxer. Yeah.
So cute.
I actually got a kick out of you, Martha Jo, on your Pinterest. I went looking at all your stuff, researching for the show, and at your Pinterest boards, you had things like, let's talk about dying, deathbed phenomenon, reinvention after loss, you know what I'm going to say, and what's your other board?
Wiggly, I haven't been on Pinterest.
Oh, wiggly boxer butts.
That's right.
I know, and I saw that, and you know what had the most pins? Wiggly boxer butts. Wiggly boxer butts.
As it should be.
As it should be. We are the same people. I get you. I saw that laugh so hard. I was like, oh my gosh, that is the best. So great. And filmmaking. How exciting is the filmmaking? Just briefly, is it around your work that you're doing or something totally different?
Yeah, it's around my work. I went to a class last September for my 50th birthday by a guy named Nick Askew. And He has a process called Interview, INNERVIEW.
Uh-huh.
And filming in black and white. And the person on the other side of the camera, The filmer, has a stillness. And I was going to say presence, but it's really not even presence. It's not like therapy. It is a place where there's no requirement. There's no need for the person to say any particular thing. And what happens is if the person will let the stillness overtake them, something happens from the inside out and they begin to speak in a different way. And Nick says it's you're speaking from the soul. Mm. And it's really quite something. It's hard to explain. That's probably the best I can do. And I've been doing a little bit more and figuring out some new ways to use it. I'm working with an 82-year-old woman right now who's at end of life, and we've just started doing this particular version with her. And it's changed the way our time has been. Before, we were filming in her house, set up the lights and do it on her couch. And when the black screen went up, there was something different. She was different. I was different. There's a field of energy. And she was able to access parts of herself that parts of herself that she hadn't before. And it was really, it was beautiful.
Wow.
So I want more of that. More of that.
More of that. Oh, I'm fascinated. I'm going to go check this out. I love storytelling, filmmaking, documentaries, connection, right? That's right up my alley. And so many people listening here, go check that out. Sounds incredible. I can't wait to see what you create. What an experience too.
Yeah, there's lots of time. We're in our homes right now, and there is time, lots of spaciousness to do things. So after I get past my anxiety, I've painted a couple of walls in my house and been for a bunch of walks. And now I'm moving into a little bit of a creative space, which I'm really happy about.
Right. I feel you. I'm in this similar space.
Do you have anxiety?
Do I have anxiety?
Yeah.
I did have some last week. In fact, that's what my last podcast episode was about, as I hit the wall myself of my wanting to save the world meter went up 5,000 notches and feeling hopeless and helpless and not knowing what to do. And I needed a break. So I was there, but I'm coming through the other side now at the moment, right? It's kind of an up and down journey.
Yeah, indeed.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for sharing. So moving forward, as I was doing research for this show, I learned so much more about you. It was so much fun. And I'm curious now, I'm not really a title person per se, but you have so many fascinating titles. And I mean, you have things like you've got a PhD in counseling education, a BA in psychology, a licensed counselor supervisor, death educator, researcher, end of life teacher, mentor. You were a former executive director at multiple places, a nonprofit founder, author, speaker, all those things. Which ones right now feel most fitting to you? Do you have one that stands out to you that makes you feel like you kind of just said you're stepping into this new role?
End of life counselor and mentor are the two that resonate most for me right now. And in the other, I'm participating in a class, somatic experiencing training class, which is a 3-year program. And I just have moved into a new cohort. And the one guy called me MJ, somebody else called me Martha Jo, and somebody else called me Martha. And they asked me what I wanted to go by. And it made me laugh because I thought this is kind of where I am right now. I'm this new identity is emerging. So I said Martha Jo. And beyond the titles, that's really it's Martha Jo.
But there you go.
End of life counselor and mentor and filmmaker are the three things that are
and filmmaker.
See, rising up right now.
A new one to
add. I know. I love it. I know.
I knew you had projects in the works. So there you beat me to the question. I love it. And then can you tell us, and we heard, you know, your bio, but in your own words, one or two sentences, what is it that you do? And then we're going to dive in way deeper in a little bit.
Yeah. So I work with people who are dying and the people who love them. Mm-hmm. To make the experience of dying between the both of them mm-hmm. as peaceful as possible. Dying mm-hmm. isn't always peaceful. There mm-hmm. are things that happen. Bodies die in different ways. And there's a way of being where people can come and be with the person who's dying and be with each other that is connective and holy and community building. And community can be your family, it can be your friends and your family, it can be you with your nurse. There's a field there. And I talk to people about what's happening with the dying process so mm-hmm. Everybody can be on the same page and it's okay to be afraid. Mm-hmm. My invitation for people is to see what they can learn so they can be present in a different way and mm-hmm. maybe set the fear aside a little bit and just be there.
So beautiful. So important. Thank you for sharing with us in your own words. And so I'm dying to know here, how the heck did you get started with this type of work? Was it something like, is a funny question, like, did you dream of being a death researcher as a little girl? Right? Like, yeah, where did this desire to help in this way come from?
I have often pondered this question, Gia.
I bet. I know.
And I've been there was a point where I was kind of embarrassed to put it out in the world because I thought, what is this? Why this? And then I'm really fascinated by the kids who come in who seem to have particular – oh, here are the dogs in the background.
I love it. Sorry, I love it. Yeah. Mine will probably be here joining me shortly. It's just how it is. Go for it.
They'll stop any moment. The kids who come in who, you know, the 3-year-old that can drum like a 30-year-old or can sing opera or has some kind of mathematical ability that they should know or some kind of knowledge about astronomy. They come in with that. And for whatever reason, the meaning making I've made is I came in with this really deep empathy mm-hmm. and compassion for people. I wear my heart outside of my body and sometimes that's not always easy, but it just mm-hmm. is, it's how I am in the world. I stayed out on a farm when I was little, probably 4 or 5 years old. And there was a mama cat and baby kittens and one of the kitties died. And I remember having a full on funeral service and I was by myself, but I took the cat kitten. I was given a little box and I took my spade and I went off beyond what are those called? The cattle guard.
Okay.
So the cattle guard is out there so that the cows won't go across. Mm-hmm. And I went on the other side of the cattle guard and dug a hole and buried this little kitty and put a little cross there. My dad was a Methodist minister, so it was the church. But I think back on that and I was so resolute and determined about doing that task. I knew I needed to do that. And it fascinates me now that I picked beyond the cattle guard because there is a space, the here space and the there space, mm-hmm. and the rest of us don't get to go there. And something in me knew that this was there was something about dying that was beyond. And so I just have always had an interest really more in people, not necessarily about dying, but more about people. Right. And then my brother died when I was 23. He had long QT syndrome. perfectly healthy, we thought. He was 37 years old, and he died in his sleep. And my world completely turned upside down. I was 24 years old, had not experienced anything like that ever. And I was twisted. I was sad and bereft and lost for a long time. And when I started to come back, I put myself back in school, put myself back to work on my master's degree because I wasn't quite sure what else to do with myself, but I knew I needed to do something. The last class I took was about starting a children's service in San Antonio that didn't exist. And I knew about a grief children's grief center in Fort Worth. And so I modeled a place in San Antonio called the Children's Bereavement Center. And my professor kindly wrote a little note and said, you really should do this. And so I didn't know any better. And I did. And in the process of building the bereavement center, people came in, community came together, and I began to heal. And I had a vision of a three-story house that had teddy bears all around the inside and hardwood floors and high ceilings. And there was a carriage house in the back and lots of parking, and I had it written down in a journal. And we ended up buying a house, group of board of directors, 332 West Craig Place, and it had all those things except the parking. And,
of course it did.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was an amazing time, and my parents were grieving, and my mother wasn't sure what in the world I was doing, and I took her to Fort Worth to visit the Warm Place, and she got it for the first time. And when you go into a place like that, if you're someone who's been exposed raw from a death, and you go into a place like that, you feel all the others who've been in that place and have left their mark there. And it's so healing. And there's not, I mean, I can tell you about it, but the words, the words are kind of irrelevant. It's you find a home for that place that you didn't know needed a home. And my mother finally got it. And then we were able to build this place in San Antonio. So beyond, I mean, it's still going. I left in 2005. They've got, two other places, one down in the Rio Grande Valley. And, there was a church shooting here outside of San Antonio a couple years ago, and they have a building out there now to work with all those families. So the legacy is just, I'm so pleased that they've been able to carry on with all that. But at the time, we had our little group and we had all of our families and we did our thing. And my family found healing in that. And that's not why I did it. And unconsciously it was. Right. But all of that move together to move me along and along to this work of grief and loss and death and dying. And it's a place that I just I'm comfortable. Mm. That was a really long answer, but there you go.
Oh my gosh. No, I loved it. Thank you for sharing this, your story with us. You just led me into where I was going without me even asking. First of all, I'm so sorry about your brother. And I was going to ask you about the nonprofit that you started, the Children's Grief Center, and where that came from. And so you just tied that so perfectly. And I also got goosebumps when you were talking about, you know, you as a little girl and innately, instinctively, whatever was in you and a part of you, you knew you were going to go bury this kitten and where you went. And I just, there's something about that. I know you know this, like as coaches, we talk about this with clients or when we work with people. And you just, if you're an observer of people, you notice that we often have a part of what we're doing with our lives that's still within us if we look back to who we are as children.
Sure.
Right? And I love that you shared that you started the nonprofit not necessarily for your family, like intentionally. You were kind of, it sounded like just following your journey and part of your gut. Is that, right?
Yeah, right? That's right.
And
that's
that right. You also didn't really know what you were doing, because I think that's so important. So many people listening want to do big things in the world, right? And me too, when I started a nonprofit many years ago, I had no clue what I was doing. And I always said, if I knew everything that went into it, I probably would have never started.
Exactly.
So do you feel the same way?
I do. This was around foster kids, is that right? Foster families?
Yeah, it was a creative arts wilderness retreat for foster kids.
Oh, cool.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's so important for people to hear over and over and over that you don't have to have all the answers or know the hows to start to do something.
It's all an experiment. Everything is an experiment. You do the thing and then you step back and look at it and see what's working and what's not. And then you recalibrate and do the next thing. And I wish I would have had those words for myself. 27 is when I started that.
Okay.
I think that would have helped me. And it does help me now as I step into new work. It's there's no perfect. There's good, but there's no perfect. And and following what feels good, in the words of Sarah Seidelman, follow your feel good, and let it be an experiment.
For sure, it's such a better way to look at things. There's a lot less pressure to just try.
Yeah, truly
try and try over again. Right. So you say we need less fear around death and dying, which I couldn't agree more, and that I read somewhere that you hope to eradicate this fear of dying in our culture. Why do you feel this is so important that you've dedicated so many years of your life to this?
When I'm with families who are able to be this capital B together, not just be together, but really be and be accepting of all of the feelings and emotions that are flying around, the experience for everybody is better. And when the person who is leaving the world is able to meet their feelings and expectations and see what's working and see what isn't, just like we were talking about a bit ago, and move with it, there's a fluidity that can't happen when the fear is running the show. And it's really quite something to be with a family. I just have been with one this last couple weeks where the person who was dying would say over and over, "I'm not scared to die. I'm scared of the pain. I don't want to hurt, but I'm not scared to die." Mm-hmm. And that set the tone for everybody else, from littles, youngest one was 9, I think, and grown kids and friends and family. Decision was made not to move forward with chemo. There was an inoperable tumor, and there were some things that could have been done that would have extended life, but it wouldn't have been a quality life in this person's, it's not what she wanted. She wanted to have quality and time and be well and not being running back and forth to the hospital with chemo.
Okay.
And so the fear, it just wasn't there for them. Mm. It just wasn't there. And it made the whole experience so much different. Now there were people who had it, and when they had it, they talked about it and they were able to move through it and find out what was underneath. And lots of times what was underneath was sadness. Mm. And we're so scared. Mm-hmm. We're so scared to feel our feelings. Mm-hmm. And if we will feel them, I'm speaking from personal experience. I was scared to feel mine for years and years. When we can feel them, we can move through them and go to the next thing, go to the next experience.
So true. So true. Yes. Thank you for sharing that story with us. And just the way you described it, I could imagine everyone in the room there and how calming and what a different experience that would be, having it facilitated that way without all the fear around it, even though you're still scared. It doesn't mean you're not scared and you're not sad, right?
Yeah.
It's just a different way of looking at approaching it.
Yeah. We're scared of the unknown. We don't know. We are. This is what's happening in our world right now. And I keep coming back to my breath. When I get worried, when I'm a day ahead or 5 days ahead or 15 days ahead, if I read the news, what's going to happen in 3 weeks, then I need to paint another wall. And I keep coming back to my breath and hand on my heart and hand on my stomach and breathing in for a count of four and breathing out for a count of four. And it really brings me back to the present moment. I look around my office for 5 things I can see, mm-hmm. listen for 4 things I can hear. I go through this process of bringing myself back to center. And I've had to do that a lot lately, but those kinds of things are, tools that I, give families too, so they can help each other come be in the present. when we're all together in the present right now, right here, right now, there's a holiness that happens. It has texture and it has feeling and often doesn't have words, but you can feel it. It's quite something.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's such a good exercise to do. If you're feeling that way to, what is it? Hand on your heart.
Hand on your heart and your hand on your stomach. And it's just an in breath of four. Mm-hmm. And you hold it for 4, 2, 3, 4 and exhale for 4.
Hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a researcher, Martha Jo, you study the deathbed phenomenon, correct? Is that right?
I love it.
Right. So can you tell us what this is exactly and then give us some examples of what it might look like, as well as share a story or two with us, maybe about some of the families or the people you've had the privilege of working with?
Yeah. So I got really interested in these when my mother was dying, and there was a kind of these things she went through, and she was far away, and she talked about the house burning down and stuff that just didn't make any sense to me at all. And then I was sitting by her bed one afternoon and her eyes were closed. She's watching something under her closed eyelids. And I asked her what she saw. And she said, it's Uncle Claude and Aunt Lala, granddaddy and grandmother, mother and daddy. And they were walking up the road from the farmhouse. And the farmhouse was an old white clapboard house that's outside of Andrews, Texas. It's not even there anymore. And she was so peaceful. And this is after having not been peaceful for a really long time.
Okay.
And it was real. It was real to her. And my brother John and I had been wondering if our brother Jim was going to be around. I mean, I knew that mm-hmm. that people had visions of dying people, but it was really kind of on the periphery of my thinking. But then we thought, oh, Mom's dying and people have visions and maybe Jim will be there. So I said, has Jim been around? And she said, oh, he's been here. And John and I had both had a dream that Jim, my brother was an attorney and an introvert, and he loved to read. And we had a dream separately, very close together, that Jim was in a chair reading a book, just kind of sitting there with mother waiting for her to get finished with what she was doing so they could go together. Hmm. And after Mom died, I started reading, there's a book called Final Gifts that was written by a couple of nurses. And so many of the things that my mother did in her dying experience were highlighted in that book. And then I got really interested in it, in this phenomenon. So as part of my doctoral studies, I talked to counselors who had been at the bedside when somebody they love demonstrated some of these behaviors. They either, the dying person saw somebody or heard somebody or had some kind of experience that seemed a little bit otherworldly to the rest of us. And what I know in my bones now is there's a very specific trajectory of dying. We all have a thumb. Mm-hmm. And we all have a thumbprint. The thumbprint is different, but we all have a thumb. We're all going to die. Our bodies know how to die. And there's this trajectory of experience that happens for people. For some people, they will raise their hand up in the air, move things around. This woman who died a couple weeks ago, or actually she died this week, but last week I got a text that she was raising her hand up in the air. And there's for some people, they look up to the ceiling and they can see a white light. Mm-hmm. And there's this reaching up towards that. And eventually they can talk about there being a white light there. They will, as my mother did, go through a period of panic where they feel like somebody's trying to burn down the house or somebody's trying to break in a door. And there are people who will say that's all, it's chemical, that your body got too much carbon dioxide or got too much medication or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's caused by. I just know that it happens. Right. And I know that it happens for different people at different times, different medications on board, different disease processes, and they have this. So as my mother talked about somebody trying to burn the house down, this person who died this week did the same thing. I got that text. Classic. The house is, somebody's trying to burn the house down. I got to get up. I got to get out of here. I got to get out. Mm-hmm. And we as caregivers will take that at face value. They want to leave the bed and they can't leave the bed. They haven't walked in 3 weeks and they're going to fall down. And it is what's happening in the moment. And if you look at it as a metaphor, I want to go, I got to get out of here. They're leaving. There's something in them that wants to go. And I think a lot about we have these egos that drive us and the ego's dying. And I liken that the house is burning down to the ego going, oh my God, I'm about to lose my body. I'm about to lose this thing that has carried me forever and ever. Spirit stays. Spirit leaves the body and goes. That's my belief system. Mm-hmm. I don't know where it goes, but it goes. There's these two separate parts. And it just fascinates me. All of it just fascinates me.
Well, my mom, as you know, my mom had dementia and her memory loss journey was about 10 years. And prior to that, my grandma had dementia, but she was much older in her 80s and it was short lived. So I've experienced death and dying through both of them. And my mom used to say that a lot, like, I got to just go. I got to get out of here. We got to go. And I got to go home. And sometimes she was often home.
Yes, exactly.
That's common too, correct?
Super common. And I talk about that being the capital H home, not this home. Yeah, somebody will be standing in their living room and I want to go home. Like, okay.
Yeah.
This sweet man got really frustrated with his wife because she kept saying that, I want to go home. And he'd say, you are home. And she would go and eat breakfast and then she would need to go back and go back to sleep for a little while. And their routine was interrupted. He was in his 90s and he would run his fingers up the piano keys to try and wake her up. And he just couldn't understand the shift that was happening. And I think this is part of my work. This is part of my calling, is to help people go, oh, something really different is happening now. It's not just confusion. They have stepped into this trajectory of experiences and we can follow this and we can help them. And no, we're not exactly speaking the same language, but I can get there with them and I can help them. And that's what I want for people. Because when you can do that, when you can meet them,
yes.
And instead of shrinking back and going, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. You do know what to do, which is really just being, I'm going to be present with them right here, right now, exactly where they are. Mm-hmm. And no, they can't get out of bed. We're going to keep them safe. And there's more going on here than I completely understand, but I know something's going on and it's going to be okay.
Right. Yeah. And once you get to, that's, I guess, one of the interesting things about, I was going to say, blessings. I don't know. I learned so much about watching my mom slowly become a different person over time and how we had to move through it, you know? And I found out the more I became childlike, the more we connected. It's kind of one of my gifts is the fun and play. And so like I could just be silly and sing songs and she would often remember things from the past, you know, like little jingles or whatever. And also just go along with her story. I'd realize, oh, she thinks she's in high school right now. Or she's talking about her home. She means her childhood home. So just pretend that's where we are. But it can be so hard. I remember my grandpa, when my grandma went through it, he was like the man with the piano keys. He just kept trying to tell her the truth. You are home, you know, and it can be so frustrating for caregivers, especially who are with them day in and day out.
Truly, truly. And for dementia patients and Alzheimer's patients, you know, there's this back in time that can be so slow, 10 years for your mother. When somebody's dying, there's that same back in time and they go backwards and backwards and backwards and you'll see them like this woman I've just been talking about, she was talking about sorting things and her hands were moving. And she said, I don't know why they're moving, but I'm sorting things. And I love that metaphor of I'm sorting what happened in my life so I can get to the place where I can lay it all down.
Oh, I like that.
The Alzheimer's and dementia people, it's a longer, to me, it's almost like they're in a loop sometimes and it takes them a long time to come out of the loop to get to the next going back in time place. don't know if that makes sense to you.
It totally makes sense to me. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And one, Martha Jo, will you share, you told a story too, just kind of a quick, I thought it was great, kind of along the same lines of what we're talking about the woman who gave her husband the bolt. Was it bolts in a Ziploc or something?
Yeah.
I thought that was such a good example. Yeah,
that's a beautiful example. So the gentleman was from South Africa, and he worked in the diamond mines, and is in his dying process, he got to a place where in his mind's eye, he was seeing something in the mines, and he was working on a machine, and he was getting really agitated. And the daughter could tell he was getting agitated, but didn't quite know what was happening. And she spoke to him in Afrikaans, and he spoke back, and he held out his hands, and he said, "I've got these machine parts, and I don't know what to do with them. I don't want to lose them." Now, in part of this deathbed phenomenon is there are often conversations about machines or cars or something, and it's broken, and we got to figure out what to do. We don't want to lose things. So she very astutely said, "Pop, I'll be right back." And she went to the kitchen and got a Ziploc bag and brought the Ziploc bag, opened it up and said, "Put the machine parts in this. I'll keep them safe for you." And he moved his hand over and put them in the Ziploc, and she, you know, zipped it up with, as far as she can see, nothing in it. And said, I'll take care of this. And then he was able to put himself, lay back in the bed and rest. It was that simple.
That simple.
It just meet them right there where they are. And he was able to do that. Another family, the guy kept talking about, "I need the suitcases." Also very common. "I need the suitcases. I need to pack. I need the map." And his two adult sons got the suitcases out and put them by the door so he could see them. Said, "Dad, we got your suitcases right here." And this man hadn't been out of bed for a long, long time, and he wouldn't get out of bed again. But he got really stuck on needing those suitcases. And once he had the suitcases where he knew where they were, he could go ahead and rest and go on to the next part of his journey. But I love that those boys were able to do that, and that and the daughter was able to do that for her papa.
And such good examples, because when you're going through it, if you've never been with a loved one who's dying or a friend, you don't know what to do. And so I think that's why this conversation is so important. And so you're giving us tools and concrete things we can do and tell us this is common.
It is common. And I also want to say, we're not supposed to know what to do. Mm-hmm. And it's okay if you don't.
Right.
We learn from being around other people and how they do it. And what I'm saying may resonate with some of you, and it may not with others.
Sure.
This is what I've observed, and this is what's been helpful for the folks I've been around, and this is what I teach. And in my experience and my observations, it's made things better.
Right. I never knew I could be so excited about death and dying because it's so fascinating. And another thing to know is that this happens with children that have visions, and people you said who are blind or can't hear, or, and it's cross-cultural, correct?
All those things. That's absolutely true. I was told a story about a 8 or 9 year old who had not been exposed to a Bible and was reciting some kind of scripture. Or scripture from the Bible. I don't remember what scripture it was, but the family was really surprised because they were not church going people. And this was at a point in the child's process where they were not speaking very often. So things happen, and cross-culturally, there are visions that happen in Japan that are similar to visions that happen here. There's a quote I found. It was some piece that was written in the 1800s, and it said something like, when the dying start seeing their own, you know the end is coming. And it was kind of this preparatory thing that people knew when people started seeing their own kin, started seeing their mama and daddy that had died a long time ago, or a brother, or you knew that time was short. And that's what we knew. But now there's a physician named Chris Kerr, Hospice of Buffalo, who's been doing research, video research on dreams of the dying, and has some really beautiful stories from people. Lots of family visits, and mostly peaceful. There are situations where people have visitors that don't necessarily engender peacefulness, but most of the time, the experience is a peaceful one.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. I have to laugh too. We got to add some humor in here, Martha Jo, because I think it was so funny. Will you tell us real quickly what your mom said when she decided to go into hospice? And you were curious. Do you remember? Do you know what I'm talking about? When you said, will you let me know, Mom?
Oh, when somebody...
Will you let me know if you start having... I forget exactly what you said. I don't want to put the words in your mouth.
You know, she was still walking and she was walking down the hallway and we hadn't really talked about it, but I said, if you see anybody, if anybody comes, will you let me know? Because I'm just really curious. And she said, well, it depends on who it is. And I don't know who she thought. I know. That just surprised me so. Yeah,
that's like maybe something you didn't expect your mom to say. I just got a kick out of that because I would have laughed if my mom said something similar to me. So
it was pretty funny. She did look. She watched for people. She was very. I think she was a little worried for a while, and then to see the peacefulness on her face when she was able to have that connection with her family. However, whether that was in her mind or whether there was something else, I mean, you could decide why all those things happen. I just know that it did happen for her. It was her reality.
Right.
And it made her really happy. And that made me happy.
Thank you for sharing. I just got a kick out of that story, what she said.
It's a good story.
Out of personal curiosity, I may be way off here, but because it's death and dying, and I personally had a my whole life flash before my eyes experience. Mm-hmm. I was hit on a bicycle when I was about 12 years old. Yeah. I think I was 12. Yeah. And I got thrown up on the hood of a car. And then in it was a matter of a second, probably, that I was on the car and then launched off.
Yes.
And at 12 years old, I lived my whole life.
Yeah.
And I can still kind of picture it. Is that another common thing or a thing that you've noticed with people, or any insight or anything? I don't know. I just wanted to ask you because it's something I've never talked to anyone really about.
That's a great question. So that is a really common experience for near-death experiencers. So for somebody who is right at the edge or goes over the edge, and there's 30 or 40 different pieces to near-death experiences that researchers have tracked now. And what you describe is one of them. People have that experience of their life flashing before their eyes. In the dying process, what I see... So if I'm working with somebody for 3 months, as they're moving into the last weeks of life, and there's lots of storytelling, typically not always, and then when they get to where they're not speaking anymore or speaking very little, there's that movement that happens. For people who sewed a lot, they may sew. A professor of mine's husband died, and she said, you know, he didn't do any of those things, except he was back at the police academy. So he had been a policeman of some sort, and he was back at the police academy. So that's a back in time thing. And in my mind, it's this backwards trajectory. And if you talked it to hospice, the nursing, not the nurses, but the nursing assistants, who go and do the baths, and it's a different level of connection and communication with those folks, with people who are dying. And they will often talk about how the people turn back almost into babies, and there's a suckle reflex that comes up. And I love talking to some of those folks and hearing their perspective. So my observation is, in the dying process, there's this backwards motion. You had in the near-death experience, it happens in an instant. And I don't know what happens when people have their eyes closed and they're off and away. This woman who was just, she came to and she looked around and she said, I'm going to go back in now. I was like, oh, where are you going back to? She was, I'm going to go back in now. Okay.
You're like, all right.
Cool.
I'm so curious. Yeah. Right. Cool. Right. Where are you going? So thank you for addressing that.
I asked you about, what happened after you had this experience of your life flashing before your eyes?
What do you mean? What happened?
So were you knocked out? Did you?
No, I was not knocked out. I actually, because I was on my bike, it actually saved my life because the bumper of the car hit my shin and my bike. So my bike went under and I went on top. So I went on the hood, my bike went under, and so then she stopped real quick, and I went flying off into the bushes. So I just had nothing minor, a blood clot in my leg and bruises, and I actually jumped up and ran to her door and asked if she was okay. It was a really weird interesting response. And then it was right by a friend of my brother's house. So the mom heard it and came running out and they brought me in. And I just remember my parents coming and, you know, of course, like, you're okay. And I don't think I registered till later. Like, I don't even remember. It's so funny. I don't even know. My dad listens to the show, if he'll even know that that happened to me. Cause I don't remember talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So that was it. It was just that moment. But I remember, I mean, it literally was all these stories of my life and people and like reliving all these things and like kind of like this, as funny as it sounds, but kind of like a bright light. And then all of these, like you're watching a movie screen of your life.
That's very common. Have you ever, the International Association for Near-Death Experiences, INDS, that might be a neat place for you to check out and, and read.
And I'm sure I'm not the only one.
I know. That has had something really like common. It's super common.
I know it is. I was just curious to talk to you about it. It came up for me as I was prepping for the show. So I know you already addressed this a little, Martha Jo, but just real quickly, because I thought this was super important. You know, I know you get asked all the time, where's the science to back this up? Is there any proof? Are you sure this is real? Can you tell us the difference, what you say, here's what I know about hallucinations and here's what I know about visions? Because I think that really helps answer that question.
Yeah, what I learned about hallucinations are that they can be controlled by medication. And visions, you can get medicine and you can still have visions. And spiders crawling on the walls, things that are creepy and unsettling, those things are controlled with medicine. And
Right, and they're scarier things, typically.
Yeah,
right?
And the visions are, it's somebody walking in your room. Sometimes people will talk about, this lady was, she said somebody would come on the end of her bed and bang a pipe. My friend Lori had some guy from the hallway. She said, do they lock the doors here at night? And I'm like, well, yeah, they do. It was an inpatient hospice. And I started thinking about it, and I said, who did you see? And she said, oh, this guy came in from the hall and he put something in my drawer and then he turned around and winked at me and then he left. So she was having a vision. And I call them friendlies, and I call them friendlies on purpose because I don't want people to be scared of them because it's not whatever the vision is. My dad had them. My dad had a basketball player that was at the end of his bed. He wanted to know if that was the Grim Reaper. And I said, well, what does he look like? He said, it's a tall black basketball player. I said, I don't think that's a Grim Reaper. Why don't you ask him? So he did. And he said, he's not. Okay. So I just call them.
That's such a great question. Why don't you ask him? That's good. That's good advice to just talk to our loved ones.
Yeah. So
thank you for addressing that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And people have all kinds of, there are people who are very resolute that this is medication induced and other people that this is remnants from a dying brain. This is low oxygen. This is, you know, 50 different reasons this happened. And again, I don't really care why it happens. I just know that it does. And if we can meet people where they are as they're having it, it makes them less anxious and fearful, which, causes us to be less anxious and fearful. And then the whole energy around them is more peaceful, which can only be good.
Only good. I love that answer. It doesn't matter why it's that it does, you know,
it's real to them.
So beautiful. It's real to them. Yes. So you helped us. I was going to ask you about helping us help our loved ones. And we dove into that. How about quickly someone who is maybe the patient themselves, someone who's dying right now. Is there any sort of word comfort you can share for someone like that? And then after someone has died, a little bit of grief or comfort, you know, that has grief. What kind of support or advice can you give to those two types of people, the patient and then someone who's grieving somebody?
So here's what I've discovered about the patient. The patients are often, I hate using patients, it's the person who's living. The person who's living their end of life experience is usually doing a lot better than the people around them. They go along and along and figure out where they are and figure out what they need. And maybe they say those needs out loud, maybe they don't. And they will find particular people to connect to help them get needs met, get some piece of business they need to get finished or something. But especially in this last year, I have been around people at end of life who are not necessarily wanting to go, but they don't need anybody to tell them it's okay. and they don't need permission. This sweet woman who just died said, I have never asked for permission for anything in my life, and I sure as hell am not going to start now. It's like, oh, you go, girl. So I when I'm with a family and we're circling the bed and the person isn't talking anymore, we'll often do some kind of ceremony and I say, we don't need anything from you. We got everything taken care of. We're right here with you until you're ready to go, and leave it at that. And I trust that when people need something, they'll figure out how to let us know. And I let people know that too. We make a lot of assumptions about people at end of life, about what they need. And maybe we need to ask a little more instead of making assumptions. And
that's so helpful.
For people who are, the other question was about after.
Yeah, grief support, like how you helped me last year.
Yeah.
Just if you have just any sort of word of wisdom. I know we did some breath work.
We did some breath work. I think we want to do something. We so often want to do something. And I get a lot of requests for what kind of book can I send? And I will put a list of books up on my website. I haven't done it, but it's going to have this caveat. And it's that the book that is attractive to you may not be attractive to the person who's grieving. And maybe sending a gift certificate for a book that they see that might be helpful to them might be more helpful than sending a book. That may not always be the case, but
That's good advice, actually. I'm thinking back to when my mom died. Someone might send me something and it doesn't resonate at all, versus they could send me a gift certificate and I could choose something.
Yeah, we see the world through our lens, and we see death and dying through our lens and our experiences and our grief, the way we grieved and what we needed. And that's not what that person needs. They are having their own experience. And if we can, just like with dying people, you meet somebody where they are. If they're sad, you be with them in their sadness and not try and cheer them up and not try and get them out of it. Just let them be there. Where they are is perfectly acceptable. And there's no need to fix anything. And my experience as a griever, when I was with people who were trying to fix me, I didn't want to be with them. When I could just be shoulder to shoulder with somebody, sitting watching the ducks on the pond, I was very happy. It's connection. How can you connect without trying to fix?
Right. Perfect. Perfect. Mm-hmm. I think that's super helpful. Yes. Thank you so much. This is so amazing. Yeah, these stories are fantastic and such good advice. So with Get Your Heart On, we talk a little bit about kind of the real talk. So these are kind of quicker, shorter answers, but I want to ask you these questions. What is your favorite part, real quick, about the work you're doing, and what is the hardest part?
My favorite part.
In a sentence.
My favorite part is the connection, the really deep, meaningful connection that happens. And the hardest part is the really deep, meaningful connection that happens with the person who's dying, because they go. And there's grief involved with that. And for some people I work with, that's harder. It's harder on me than others. And I really have figured out different ways to take care of myself over that time. But that connection is powerful and wonderful. And, you fall in love with people and it hurts sometimes.
Oh yeah. I can imagine. And you just led right into my next question, was self-care is so huge for big-hearted people and empathy driven, compassionate people. And you're so amazing at helping others. How you gave us some breath work, but how do you take care of yourself? Is there anything other things that
you
do?
So I have a piano. I just bought a piano this year, and this work with Nick, the filmmaker guy, has been really wonderful, because he talks about just you don't have to prove anything. You don't have to be anybody to be anything special to anybody. Just be yourself and do what you love. And so I've been building a lot of fires, and I have a big fire pit in my backyard, and I'll go out and build a fire. It just makes me really happy, and play my piano a lot. And I'm not playing for anybody but myself. And I really love both of those things. I love to be outside. When I've had been in a situation that's really touched me, I know I need to be out and let the air go and roll down the windows in the car and drive and just let all that, imagine the wind blowing those things out. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. That's so funny you just said piano because I have a call later this afternoon to take piano
Oh,
lessons with virtual piano lessons. I get so excited. I played as a little girl, but I keep wanting to do it. And now I'm like, okay,
takes time.
we're doing
Good
it.
for you.
Yeah, it brings your brain somewhere. I want to be to the level where I can just sit and close my
Yes.
eyes and go to another
Yes.
world. So I felt you on that one. So we've been talking all about how you make a difference in the lives of others, Martha Jo. How has someone made a difference to you? Can you share a story or a moment with us?
So I don't remember what had happened in the morning, but I had had a terrible morning and my face was puffy because I'd been crying and I decided I needed to take myself to Starbucks. And I went to Starbucks and it was my regular barista. And she looked at me and gave me my coffee order. And then she moved a little snowman cookie she had to the between me and the between me and her. And she broke it. And she handed it to me and she said, "Oh my gosh, this cookie is broken. I think you need a cookie today." And it was so sweet.
Oh, I got
Isn't that so
goosebumps. I was like,
sweet?
what? I'm thinking, why did she break the
So she could
cookie?
just give it to me because she couldn't just give it to me regular, but if it was a broken cookie, yeah.
Right. Then it goes in the trash. They can't
Exactly.
serve
Oh,
broken cookies, but you
so made me smile.
Oh, that's such a beautiful and simple,
Simple.
easy way.
Exactly.
That's, yeah, right. It
So
meant so
simple.
much.
It
I
did.
love that. So going back to the basics, Martha Jo, kindness. What does being kind mean to you, and why does it matter?
Kindness to me is deeply linked to safety. When somebody is kind, there's something in them that feels safe to me. And when I'm kind, I hope that I can engender that kind of feeling for somebody else so they feel safe. And we're in a time where so many people feel unsafe, and little acts of kindness build on each other and for me help build some good energy inside, I guess. I'm looking for the R word and it's not coming up. Anyway, I
Yeah,
just
I'm.
it's
I don't know
yeah
what word.
I don't know what word it is either.
That's
Resilience, there
okay.
we go. When
Oh, yes.
somebody's kind, it somehow it comes into me in a different way than compassion does, or I don't know. And I remember saying about my partner one time, somebody asked me what it was about her, and I said, "She's so kind to me." And I think it's a value that is important and I cherish. So I try to be that too.
Beautiful. So this is the pay it forward piece at the end of every interview. And I want to, because I want to encourage everyone here to get their heart on. That's what we do together and to take action. So do you have a favorite way or you'd like to pay it forward or that we could share some super love with people that you like to do or have done
This is
in the
my
past recently?
very new favorite thing, and
Okay.
I learned this from Peter Shankman, and I took did a little bit different twist on it. I
Okay.
got a bunch of Amazon gift cards. Got $100 of Amazon gift cards in $10 increments. And when I am around somebody who is being especially kind or especially helpful or makes me laugh, something that's just out of the ordinary for me, I'll pop that out and leave it for him somehow. So I had a waitress in the airport recently when the airport was really shut down, and it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and she was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and I left the regular tip and I left that card in there too.
Oh, love
Yeah, and
that.
there's a yeah, it's just it's finding. For me, when so many things are kind of falling apart, looking for the good, looking for the helpers, and connecting with them, and that's what it is. It's not the 10 bucks. It's the connecting with somebody and letting them know that they matter.
Right, and being thought of and just a little kind gesture. I love that. So easy to do
It
too.
is, and it's
So
fun.
thanks for
It's really
sharing.
fun.
And fun, right? Yeah.
That's
Just get a surprise, little surprise someone doesn't expect.
right.
That's awesome. So before we go, is there anything you wished I'd asked or a loose end or any closing thoughts that you want to share with us?
No, I appreciate your willingness to talk about death and dying. It's something that some people are terrified to to go towards, and we're all going to die. Well, no people are going to die. And if we can talk about it, Mr. Rogers says, if what's mentionable is manageable. And I appreciate you being willing to mention this. I think it helps a lot.
Oh, it does help a lot. And it's, you know, it is something we don't talk about, and it's so important and natural, like you said. So I'm honored you spent the time with me. So from your website homepage, Martha Jo, I wanted to know if you would like to read this, or if you'd like me to read just kind of the top of your website, because I think it's so beautifully said and stated.
Yeah. So it says, when someone you love is dying, there's a space in the experience that is holy and true in a way that not much else is. Beautiful. Yes. And it can all be really hard, both and.
I love that. It touched me so much, and I wanted to share it with our listeners as well. Thank you for reading that to us. And thank you so much for this much-needed conversation and for shining a hopeful light today on this topic that's, like we said, not often talked about, but yet so important, as birth and death are part of life. We're all going to die. It's not a shocker, right? So why not learn more about it and how to support one another through the process, which you so amazingly do. So thank you for so openly sharing part of your story with us. It's such an honor, like I said, to spend time with you today. And where can we go to find you, connect with you, get your book, watch your talk, all that? Is there a good place to send people? I'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah, just come to my website, marthaatkins.com.
Perfect.
Best okay. place to come. Thank you.
Gotta love it. You go to one place and there you are. And you guys are going to want to find her on Facebook. Is that where you're most active on socials, Facebook?
Yes.
Okay.
I do.
You
I
are
do
so like great. Facebook. Yeah, you share great stories and it's positive and fun. Just if you want to go find a more positive, compassion, joy, go find Martha Jo on Facebook.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone who joined us today. I hope you are even more inspired and ready to share your big, amazing heart with others in your own beautiful way. Martha Jo, one last time, thank you so much for being who you are and for choosing to show up in the world the way that you do. So much love and gratitude to you. You truly are making a difference in the lives of so many people. Thank you. And thank you for tuning in and joining us, you guys. Much love going out to all of you. Can't wait to connect with you next week. Bye.